January 5th, 1987. My mom is so proud. My children are happy. My grandchildren have never seen me take a drink. And the state of Texas is relieved. I have not been married since I've been sober. My sponsor told me I never had to get married again if I didn't want to. And I haven't found it necessary. Now, I've had some serious relationships, you know, and when the last one ended, I just went and bought a new Harley. So, I know where it is every night. It starts when I want it to, it stops when I want it to, and needs very little maintenance. So, we're happy with that. So, I'm honored to be here, and I stand on the shoulders of giants, and you know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love this way of life. And I thank God I didn't get what I deserve. You know, I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a sponsor. I have service commitments. And I sponsor women that make me look so good, you know. I just have to tell you, I just got off the phone a little while ago with a gal that I sponsor, and she sent me pictures of her and her daughter. She has not seen her daughter in 4 years. So, you know, we expect miracles here. We know they're coming, and so we just expect them to come. And I'll be forever grateful for this way of life that found me, and eternally grateful. I want to thank everyone who had anything to do with putting this on today. This is not an overnight matter. You know, it takes a lot of work and a lot of commitment. And so I really applaud everybody for everything they've done. And I want to thank Christine for inviting me to come here. And I want to thank hooking me up with the hostess, with the mostest, Michelle over here. We have really had a good time. I've enjoyed all the speakers and have gotten something from everyone. And that's the beauty of these things, you know. It doesn't matter where you come from or where you've been. But we get something from everybody, and we touch each other's lives. And I love that things are opening back up, because I'm a people person. I like the hugs. I like to look people in the eye. And it's been a great pleasure for me. So anyway, I'll say a little bit about what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. I grew up in a family of alcoholism. My father was a wife-beating, child-beating alcoholic. He was in the military. My father, I found out, did time in South Dakota. He did time in Folsom. He did time in San Quentin. And this was all before he met my mother. My mother knew nothing about that. But when the Korean War came around, they needed volunteers. And so that's how my father got out of prison. So the Army really, back then, really enabled him to continue doing what he was doing, which was drinking. And I remember we started out, I was born in Georgia, and then we went to Germany. And I can remember many times where my father would come in, and he would beat the holy hell out of my mom. I mean, she would have black eyes and busted lips and get up the next morning, and he would come in, and he'd go, what happened to you? And we were so confused. I mean, you just did this the night before. And he had been in a blackout. But we didn't understand anything about alcoholism. We knew when he drank, he was like what the big book says. He became dangerously and disgustingly antisocial. And so he would, he would do that. Sometimes the neighbors would call the military police. They would come over and they would tell my mom not to upset my dad. You know, and that's just how it was back then. We ended up in Texas, and my father would retire. And when the abuse started with my sister and I, my mom had had enough. And she said, you either quit drinking or leave. And he left. And for years and years, and for prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought my father left because he didn't love us, that he chose alcohol over his family. But what I know today, without a shadow of a doubt, my father leaving was the only kind and loving thing he could do, because he could not stop drinking. I don't know if he was ever introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. I know he went to detox several times and would drink bay rum hair tonic, you know, whatever they could get. And so it was really rough on my mom, you know. Being a divorced woman back in the 60s was not a popular thing. You know, she couldn't get credit, you know. And so my mom went above and beyond the call of duty. And my mother was the first woman postal carrier in the two counties that I live. Now, she is pretty amazing. She is tough, tough, tough. My mom is 91 years old, almost 91 years old, and I'm her primary caretaker today. But I will tell you this. There was something wrong with me long before I ever took my first drink. I was born restless, irritable, and discontent. I have this sister who was 3 years older, God rest her soul, and she was the class favorite. She was the straight-A student. She was the Miss Hearn High School. She was all those things. And on Friday nights, while she was cheering the football team on, I was in the parking lot stealing hubcaps, you know? I mean, I wasn't good at getting positive attention, but I was good at getting negative attention. And if you're a kid like me, negative attention was better than no attention. And by God, I had to have attention. And so, you know, my mom is working hard. I mean, sometimes she would take 2 and 3 jobs to keep a roof over our head, and she refused to take any government assistance. And I would love to tell you that on those days that my mom was walking 10 miles a day carrying a 70-pound mail sack, that she would come home to a clean house and a cooked meal. But that's not the case. Because you see, there's something wrong with me. It was all about what I wanted to do and where I wanted to go and who I wanted to be with. I was totally so self-absorbed, not even knowing what that was. But she's working and wanting me, trusting me to do the right thing, and that never happened. You know, I started stealing as soon as I could walk. I started lying as soon as I could talk, and that's just how it was. So I ended up in this town, Hearn, Texas, which is 17 miles away from where I live now in Bryan, and it's where my home group is today. And so I hung around with other kids that were just like me, and it wasn't a big deal. I didn't start drinking until I was 12, and that's kind of late nowadays, you know. So it wasn't a big deal, and the neighbor's kids and I were walking down the street, and the neighbor had his garage door open. And in his garage were cases of Long Neck Miller beer. I can still see that old gold label on there. And so we looked around at each other, and we went in and we stole some of this hot Long Neck Miller beer. It was the heat of the summer. And we went down to my friend's house, and we opened it up. Of course, it foamed all over. We sucked that foam down, drank enough of that hot Miller beer, enough to where we got that feeling of intoxication, instantly followed by nausea and vomiting. We didn't have those skills that would come later on. You know, appropriately coating your stomach before you go out drinking, putting your finger down your throat to puke so you could go back and drink some more. Nor did we know about putting one foot on the floor to keep the room from spinning, but that would come with time. And we got up the next morning, I had my first hangover. My head was pounding, my eyes were bloodshot, and we're in the bathroom putting water in our faces, and my friend looked at me and said, "My God, Mickey, I'll never do that again." And the rest of our years in junior high and high school, that girl never did that again. She saw what the problem was, made the correction, and went on about her way. And I was just as sick as she was, and I said, "You're absolutely right. I'll never do that again either." And I never did. I never drank hot Miller beer again. That brief period of intoxication was so elusive that for the next 20 years of my life, I would do whatever I could to, at once again, experience that sense of ease and comfort that came at once by taking a few drinks. You see, for the first time in my life, that put me, I was okay in my own skin, and I had never had that before. I had this anxiety about me that I had to be doing something all the time. And alcohol just made me okay. So we started seeking out the creepy guy at 7-Eleven to go buy your booze, or, you know, whatever we had to do, rob parents' liquor cabinets, whatever we had to do. But I started out doing that. And I guess I was about 14 years old when I found better living through chemistry. Started smoking those funny cigarettes, taking a lot of those black market pills where you take trips and never leave the room. Want to paint a house without a ladder. Lay on the ground, listen to the grass grow. Took a lot of prescription pills. My name was never on the prescription bottle, but I took a lot of prescription pills. And it was not uncommon to find me out in a cow pasture after a heavy rain. So, you know, when I tell you I'm a real alcoholic, my problem's not alcohol. And my problem's not those other things I do after I've been drinking. My problem is living life sober. I don't like sober. Sober was boring. Sober was difficult. And by God, I had to have something to give me some relief, you know? Just give me something. And so, you know, I'm a blackout drinker. I don't think if you didn't black out, you didn't have a good time. Of course, everybody had to tell you what you did, but I'm a blackout drinker from the beginning. And it doesn't matter what it is. I had no preference of any. Strawberry Hill. Remember that? Yeah. MD 2020. Got you some of that? You know, some of that good stuff. Get you quicker. Get you quicker. And so, you know, I started getting a reputation for being able to drink the football players under the table. Now, there's a thing about that, you know, because we're drinking and they're passed out or they're vomiting and I'm still up partying. So it's the illusion of control. You see, I'm controlling it. And I didn't realize I was developing a disease that would ultimately almost destroy me. Because this thing is progressive. You know, I had a lot of fun times, but it's progressive. And for me, it progressed quickly. I don't know anything about social drinking. The only thing I ever did socially was spread a little VD. So... It was the 60s, you know, we all did that. And, you know, unfortunately, I'm not exempt from those things that happen to young girls when they put themselves in that situation. And so, you know, it just kept on and on and on. Got into a little trouble, you know, the cops back then, they'd call your family, which is probably worse than going to jail, but I did go to jail a couple of times. And it just wasn't a big deal. It's just what we did. It's what we did. And a lot of things started happening to me in a very short period of time. When I did my first fifth step with my sponsor, I realized that all my life, all I ever truly wanted was to be loved, to feel special, to feel wanted, to feel needed. And I didn't know how to get that in a healthy way. So for what happened for me at 16, I traded all that for sex, wanting nothing more than to be loved and important and special to someone. And what happened at 16 years of age, I got pregnant, not knowing what to do. If you're 16 and pregnant in this day and age, it's not a big deal. But in 1972, in small town Texas, it was a big deal. My sister, who was 3 years my senior, had moved to Austin, and I went and stayed with her and brought an illegitimate child into the world. By God's mercy, a family came into my life that said, we will take this child and raise it as our own with the condition you never see this child again. And I made that deal. I made that deal because I knew it was best for that child. I was in no shape or had any ability to raise a child at 16. So I signed those papers and I let that child go. And I had no tools to deal with that kind of loss. And I came back to a small town, Texas, with a scarlet letter on my forehead. Everyone knew what had happened. And I literally, at 16, had to have alcohol or some other chemical in my body that would allow me to walk out on the street and hold my head up and say, I don't care what you think. But you see, I'm an alcoholic. I have this built-in sixth sense. All I had to do was walk out, and anybody that looked at me, I knew what they were thinking. And I'm telling you, I shamed myself to the pit of hell for what I thought you were thinking. And, you know, it's amazing that still sometimes today I get in trouble for thinking I know what you're thinking. I don't know how I graduated high school, honest to God, don't, other than I think they wanted me out of there. So 45 minutes after I graduated high school, I am out of small town Texas. Because you see, that's my problem. Hearne, Texas was my problem. And if I can just get out of there and go somewhere where no one knows me and I can start over, I'll find me a good man to get married to and I'll have children to replace that child. Because you see, I have a God-sized hole in my soul that I don't know how to fill up. Not until I found you. So I moved 500 miles away to a small town right outside of New Orleans, Louisiana, where they party 24/7. Not a good move for someone like me. But I had the best intentions, you know. I was going to go and I get married, have these children, join the PTA, and one day I'll come back and show them all, you know. And so I moved to this small town. I'm there 2 weeks before I end up in jail. 2 weeks. And I'm thinking God is punishing me, that I'm snake bit, that if it wasn't for bad luck, I'd have no luck at all. Now, it doesn't take a genius to get out of jail. It just takes time. And so I had nowhere to go, and I never called home my mom to get me out of jail. So I stayed in St. Charles Parish Jail for long enough, and when I got out, Plan B kicked in. I ended up marrying the guy I got busted with so he couldn't testify against me and I couldn't testify against him. You got to have a reason to get married, right? So we took in sick together, and of course you know what happened. I immediately got pregnant. I was desperate to fill this void. There had not been any counselors on street corners like there seems to be nowadays. And I just had no tools to deal with that level of pain. And so we took in sick, and I had these two children from that marriage. And I moved back to Texas in early 1980. And I like to say move because it sounds better than unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. So, you know, it's really kind of bizarre because you're heading for that state line, you know, and it was one of those spiritual moves in the middle of the night where you got the U-Haul and you're just throwing everything in it, you know, heading for that state line. You get there and you kind of wipe the sweat off your brow and you're never going back there ever, ever, ever again. Of course, you're really okay. You don't know there's a step nine in your future. So, you know, you go. But by the time I got back to Texas, I had made a lot of really, really poor decisions. And one of those was one night under the influence of alcohol, I let a friend put a needle in my arm. And so by the time I got back to Texas, I knew about living one day at a time, long before I came to you, and doing whatever I had to do to make it one more day. And I'm not proud of the person I became. I'm not proud of the things that I did, things that I felt I had to do to get what it was to survive. Of course, my marriage would fall apart. I was kind of amazed when I came into AA and I heard somebody say, it takes two healthy people to have a healthy relationship. That was news to me, you know. Wow. And so, yeah, we were not good together. But I'm a mother, an alcoholic, and I have these two children, these two beautiful little children. And I wanted nothing more than to be a good wife. I wanted nothing more than to be a good mother. But I'm an alcoholic, and those things just don't mix. I don't believe there's anything more powerful than a mother's love for her child except alcoholism, because it took me from my children on a regular basis. I'm the alcoholic woman that goes to the store for a loaf of bread, and I don't come back for several days, sometimes a week, maybe even longer. And I left my children with people children don't need to be left with. Children don't need to be left with. And my children heard things that no child should ever hear. My children saw things that no child should ever see. And my children experienced things that no child should ever experience because their mother's an alcoholic. And I'm powerless to understand what's going on with me. I think I'm crazy. I just don't know. You know, I would go out and I would come home and I would be so sick and tore down. And I've got these beautiful little children with a washcloth cleaning their mama up. And they say things to me that I know are the truth. They say, you know, mama, if you don't drink, you won't get sick. And I knew that. I mean, you know the truth when you hear it. And so I'd start walking off that drunk, and I'd start walking back and forth, pacing the floor. And I made those promises to those kids so many times, over and over. And they know the truth when they hear it too. And they believe me because I meant it. We're going to stay home tonight. We're going to pop some popcorn. We're going to watch a video. We're going to go to the park this weekend. And the circus is coming to town. And we surely don't want to miss that. And I'm walking back and forth, back and forth. And that hand starts to shake. And when that hand starts to shake, that knot starts in my stomach. And then the obsession hits. And an obsession is not that I run through the house like a crazed maniac, although on many occasions I have. The obsession is just this idea that comes to my head that says, you know, Mickey, if you take one, take a drink, it'll calm those nerves, it'll settle that stomach, and you can go to the park with those kids. And so you take that drink, and then the allergy kicks in. An allergy that I had no clue of understanding. An abnormal reaction to a food or chemical. I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. When I take one, I want more. So the obsession hits, then the allergy hits, and I got to go to the store for a loaf of bread. And I did that repeatedly over and over and over. You know, I've been brought to my knees many times, you know, in sobriety. But one of the things brought me to my knees when I was 6 years sober. My daughter was having a hard time. She was 14 at the time, and she had started dating this little guy in school. And she came to me because she was having some issues. And what she brought to my plate would sink me to the bottom. The reason she was having problems with this little boy in school is because when she was between the ages of 4 and 8 years old, while I was at the store getting a loaf of bread, she would be repeatedly molested by the neighborhood 15-year-old boys. How do you make amends for that? Saying you're sorry just kind of describes your character. And I don't know how to prove this to you any other way, but the mercy of a loving God intervened in us. And we went to our Al-Anon family, and we went to our alcoholic women, and we got together, and I was able to get her the professional help she needed. And today she walks a free woman. And she allows me to tell that story because she says, Mom, I know we're not the only ones. We're not the only ones. And so, you know, that daughter of mine, she's something else. She's not an alcoholic. I don't know how. But she's the one that when we go out to eat, we'll go to the restaurant. She'll order her a drink. She's certainly of age. She'll order a drink, and she'll drink maybe a third of it, maybe a half of it, because I'm watching, you know. And she'll get up and leave, and I'll say, aren't you going to finish that drink? No, Mom, I'm starting to feel it. Well, yeah. And she starts to feel it, and she doesn't want any more. And see, when we start to feel it, that's when we want more. She flies with me a lot, and she has to take Xanax, the lowest dose you can possibly get. So she goes to the doctor. She gets a prescription for 5 pills. She took one. I had to lead her through the airport in San Francisco. She took one on the way home. I had to lead her through the airport on the way home. And about a year later, I had a headache. I went to get some Tylenol out of her medicine cabinet, and I see this pill bottle. Of course, I'm going to look, right? So I look, and there's three left in the bottle. And I'm like, why haven't you taken this? She said, well, we haven't been on a plane again. I said, you haven't been anxious in the last year? You know, go figure. But that's what they do. You know, I'm abnormal. It affects me differently. Well, I don't want to run out of time. But if you're paranoid and you think they're out to get you, they are. And in 1986, they came and got me. And I was charged with a first-degree felony, punishable by up to 99 years in the penitentiary. Now, I thought they were just getting a little bit too serious in Texas, you know? I mean, and after all, another thing they hit me up with was, I'm just hanging out with my buddies, my pals, my compadres. They call that organized crime, and they don't like that, you know? So I go to jail. I bonded out, and I'm one of the alcoholics that gets in trouble when you're in trouble. I see a few of y'all around here. And so I went back to jail, and I was held at no bond. And I lost everything that was important to me. And I sat in jail long enough, and I heard that jailhouse talk. And they all said, if you go to AA, it looks good when you go to court. So I was just about willing to go to any lengths to look good when I went to court. So they set me down for another pretrial, and they offered me 20 years in the penitentiary. And I thought that was a little bit too steep, so I decided to take it to a jury trial. Now, they say it's a jury of your peers, but there wasn't anybody there I'd have hung out with, I tell you that, you know. So I decided to go check out these AA meetings. So I went to the Bryan Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you did what we do. You welcomed me with open arms. You said, come in, sit down. You're the most important person here. I'm thinking to myself, I know that. I mean, I'm facing 99, okay? And they began to share what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. And one guy got up, and he talked about his drinking had gotten so bad that his wife left him. And the pain of that was so great that he put the plug in the jug and went to AA, and his wife came back, and his life is wonderful. And I'm thinking to myself, dude, one wife, one time? I mean, come on, you know? Hang in there. I know women that'll drink with you. Don't give up. But he was talking about true love, and I was so far removed from any of that. I didn't know what he was talking about. And then some girl jumps up in the back, and she has saved enough money at this minimum wage part-time job she's worked at to buy this used vehicle. And, oh, everyone just applauded. And I said, chick, see me after the meeting, man. I'll get you a better deal than that. Might not have a title, but I'll get you a better deal than that. But she was talking about an honest day's pay for an honest day's wage. I was so far removed from that, I didn't hear what she was saying. I didn't hear the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I ended up going through this trial by an impartial jury, and they found me guilty because I was. And this jury came back with probably the worst sentence you can do to somebody like me. 10 years intense supervision probation. Now, I'm not the kind of person that likes to be told what to do, you know, and I didn't want to go to prison for 20 years, but I was ready to go do my little turnaround, come back out, and run my life. Now, by this time, I'm living in an abandoned house. I have no running water, no electricity. I've got this truck that when I got busted, they didn't take because they didn't want, And I'm worried about somebody telling me what to do. But here, these probation, they're going to be telling me where I can go, where I can't go, who I can see, who I can't see, pee in a cup, you know? I was furious. I got convicted in December of 86, and the judge gave me until February 5th to get my life in order. He said, you better dot every I and cross every T, or I'll be happy to send you to prison. And so I was to start probation on February 5th in 1987. In case you don't remember, my sobriety date's February 5th, 1987. I would love to tell you that going to jail changed me. I would love to tell you that going to jail never did anything but really make me angry. But, you know, I'm one of those that is pretty hard-headed, and they say when you hit bottom, there's only one way but up. Well, when I hit bottom, I'm kind of flop around like a fish out of water, you know? And I just can't seem to put the shovel down. And I had one young man that was left in my life. I always liked those young men. I always thought if you got them young enough, you could train them. So you would go out to those sordid places. Oh, I love the way Bill calls them, sordid places. Oh, I love sordid places. And I would go out there, and I would see him across the dance floor, and I'd do whatever I had to do to hook him in, and I'd give him my experience, strength, and hope. And then they eventually get an idea of their own that you don't approve of, so you got to get rid of them. But you can't get rid of them until you have another one over here, right? Can't ever be without one. Who are you going to blame? So, you know, this went on and on. I found out when I did my fifth step that whatever this guy did that I had to get rid of him, the next guy paid for it. And then whatever this guy did, the next guy paid for these two. So I ended up abusing a lot of young men for things they never did. And, you know, just absolutely insane. But I had this one young man, he was left in my life. He had gone through the whole ordeal with me, watched me lose my children, watched me lose all my possessions, and he had hung in there with me. Probably would have been a good candidate for Al-Anon. But his name was Bud. He was 24 years old. Cute, cute, cute. And he came to me one night in this abandoned house. No running water, no electricity, a little Coleman lantern. And he began to ask me questions that I had no answers for. He began to ask me what life was about. I had no clue. He began to ask me what I was going to do. And I had no clue. And then he made a grave error as he began to point out my failures. He began to point out that I had just gotten through with this trial, and that I had lost everything that I had, and I'm still doing the exact same thing that put me there. And I don't know about you, but anytime anybody reminds me of my failures, I do whatever I have to do to get you out of my face. If that's attack you physically, done. But what's worse is the sword of the tongue. And I began to chop this young man up slice by slice. And he eventually dropped his head and his shoulders, and he said, Mickey, I can't live like this anymore. And I made the grandstand play I've made so many times before. You go ahead and leave, big boy, because I don't need you. I don't need anybody. I don't need anything. And if everyone would leave me alone, I'd be okay. And I believe that. I believe that. And that young man walked out my house that night. It was rainy. It was cold. And he walked out, and I did whatever I had to do to make it go away for one more night. Just for God's sake, let me have some relief. The sun came up the next morning, as it always does. And I went outside, and I found his solution to our problems. And that young man's body hung from a tree limb with a rope around his neck. And while I was making it go away for one more night, he was making it go away for eternity. You see, that's what happens to people like us when we have no solution. And I had no solution. The bad thing was is he came to someone who had no solution. And I'm going to tell you, from that moment on, I've seen dead people before, but I looked death in the face that morning. And when you have no God in your life, no working God in your life, the thought of a death such as that is just almost unbearable. I started running. And have you ever tried to outrun your head? I mean, I'm running, I'm going crazy. And the gift happened, the gift of surrender. The gift of surrender is the thing that has to happen to bring us here, and it's the thing that has to happen to continue to keep us here. And what happened for me was I'm driving around in this truck, $12.50 truck, got it in a drug deal, gave a guy half a gram of dope, gave me the truck, figured it out one day that truck cost me $12.50, and I got ripped off. I told you they didn't want it. And so I pulled off on the side of the road because what surrender for me came in the form of a tear. And this one tear, because I'm a tough broad, I don't cry. But when that one tear started down my face, it opened the floodgates for years of uncried tears. And I just pulled over and just bawled like a baby. I don't know how long I was there. I have no way to measure any time. And after a while, I sat up and I looked around and I had that deja vu feeling. And it took me a few minutes to realize that these people were walking down the sidewalk and I was outside that stupid AA meeting I had been to many months before. I never thought about ever going back there again. But here's people walking with carrying the beautiful book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know if I don't get in there, I'm going to die. And so I started up the sidewalk and fell and literally crawled into what I consider my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd love to tell you that the Brian group of AA rushed to my side with a plate of donuts and a cup of coffee, saying, "Let us help you up, you poor, precious child of God." But they knew what had happened. And they came and they looked down their long, skinny noses at me and they said, "Are you sick and tired of being sick and tired?" And I was sick. I was tired, and I don't remember anything that was said in that meeting except somebody said, "Keep coming back." Well, I had nowhere else to go, and I don't know how many meetings I had been to or anything until I suddenly remembered I was supposed to see this stupid probation officer. We didn't have cell phones. I didn't have a mailbox. There was no way to find me anywhere. But I remembered I was supposed to meet her February 5th, 1987. So I go in and see this probation officer. Now, I had been coming to meetings long enough to where I heard this was a program of total abstinence. So I went totally abstinent. And the poison that I was putting in my body didn't react very well to that. And so I went in there and she said, "My God, Mickey, can you do this by yourself?" I said, "No, my skin is peeling, my hair's falling out, I'm vomiting uncontrollably." And so she tried to get me into somewhere. But in Texas, in that day and age, the only thing they had available was Austin State Hospital, and it had a 3-month waiting list, and I was dying today. When AA says they can love you sober, by God, I'm living proof. I sat in those chairs and hung on to them, and I shook like crazy. And I did vomit on myself, and you cleaned me up and gave me some nourishment, and you said if you'd never put any more of this stuff in your body, you'll never have to go through this again. And I dared to believe you. I hung on, and I dared to believe you. After about 6 weeks, I started feeling better. And then the danger comes. Because when I feel good, I'm sitting in the back of the room, and I'm telling you how big and bad and tough I am. Let me tell you about those big deals I made out there. Let me tell you what's really going on, what it's like out there on the street. And finally, a guy named Charlie, every group's got a Charlie. Charlie's got 15 years sober, got an answer for everything. And I found out if you're new and if you go to an old timer and if they don't know what the answer is, they tell you it's in the book. I use that all the time now. But Charlie came to the back of the room and he said, "Mickey, why don't you fix your coffee and come sit up front with us?" And I thought, well, they finally want to hear what it's really like out there, you know? So I fixed my coffee and sat next to Charlie, who leaned over and said, "Sit here and shut up and listen." And Charlie saved my life. I couldn't believe he was talking to the most important person at the meeting like that. So I sat there and I shut up and I listened. And for the next 3 months, the only thing they let me do in an AA meeting was read How It Works, because there were no cuss words in How It Works. I threw one in every now and then just to kind of liven that thing up, boy, because it got dull quick. And then they made me the greeter at the door. Now, you had to really want to be get sober when I was greeter at the door. I don't look anything like I look now. When I got sober, I weighed about 115 pounds. I'm 5'10". I thought I was looking good, but I was sunk in places you ain't supposed to be sunk in. I had this pasty gray complexion because I hadn't seen the sun in 7 years. I came in with skin-tight blue jeans or these black leather pants tucked in these knee-high boots with the brass tip on the end because I'm bad. I got a big black wallet in my back pocket with a dog chain that hangs down to my knee and hooks up on my belt because I'm tough. I got a big wad of keys on my hip so it makes a lot of noise when I walk. You hear me long before you see me. Now I'm living in an abandoned house. My truck starts with a screwdriver, but I got a big wad of keys over here on my hip. I had this big black leather jacket on that had this fringe that hangs down all over it. Had to pull this hat way down over my eyes. And I had to wear sunglasses in the meeting because that light was just a little bit too bright. I had those gloves that have the fingers cut out, you know. And I'd sit and look at you and do this. And I'd stand by that door and I'd say, "Come in, sit down, shut up, this is AA." You had to really want to get sober. I scared a few people sober. So Charlie kept talking to me about getting a sponsor. And I'd look at this young man over by the coffee pot. He's got about 30 days. I'd say, "Charlie, I bet he could keep me sober tonight." Charlie said, "Men work with men and women work with women." Well, see, I hated women. Hated women. Absolutely. Found out my fifth step, I hated women because I thought they were all like me. But I really hated women. All my life, I tried to learn what it was to be a woman from a man. And I had to have women, and I just didn't realize it. So I was going around, wouldn't get a sponsor, and I became a chronic complainer. This isn't Darren earlier talking about complaining in those meetings. I mean, I've got a $12.50 truck. I'm living in an abandoned house. I mean, I don't have anything going on. I've just been convicted of this first-degree felony, and I would just complain. And this woman came up to me after a meeting one night, and she said, "Mickey, I want to tell you, you're full of shit," and turned around and walked off. I couldn't believe she was talking to the most important person at the meeting like that. And I went to explain that to her when my mouth opened and a voice like mine said, "Will you be my sponsor?" Well, grave error again. I mean, aren't we supposed to have somebody that has walked the same path that we've walked, speak the same street language that we speak? Thank God, no. Thank God. Linda Kay turned around and looked at me from the top of my head to the tip of my toes and square in the eye, and she said, "I don't like you, but I'll help you because I have to stay sober." Well, la-ti-da, you know. Thank God God put Linda in my life because she knew the book. And we were so polar opposite. She had been a whack in the Army. I mean, you know. So she said, "Do you have a big book?" I said, "No." She said, "Do you have any money?" I said, "No." She said, "Well, steal one. You can make amends later." So I did. So I stole my first big book. I've given away a lot of them, I promise you. And I would complain, and she would say horrible things to me like, "Well, get a job." She said, "What do you know how to do?" I said, "Well, weights and measures, you know, a little bit of sales. And so I went to the noon meeting, and they said, are there any AA-related announcements? I said, yes, I need a job. And by the time that meeting was over, I had my first sober job. I went to work in a sink factory, drilling holes in marble sinks on an assembly line in a 120-degree sweatshop. But I learned about punching a time clock. I learned about being there. I learned about a day's pay for a day's wage. You know, I started learning to do those things very simply. My probation officer was very influential in my life, and she saw how I was really struggling, and she helped me get into school. And eventually I got some initials behind my name that allowed me to have the career that I've had. And so, you know, things were going along good. I got involved in the H&I committee, and every weekend I was taking meetings into prisons and doing whatever I could. You know, if the JCs wanted to know about AA, I'm your gal. You know, the Lions Club wants to know, yes, take me, I'm your gal. And I just started doing these things because I don't want to die. I don't want to drink. And I am starting to like this stuff, you know? It feels good. I was feeling free from the bondage of myself. I started with this little job I had. I moved into an apartment in the bad part of town, and I would get out of my truck and I would hold my breath till I got in that apartment because I didn't want to test positive when I went to see my probation officer. And Linda took me to the book and taught me how to read the book. She explained to me that step one was my problem statement, that I'm powerless because of this obsession and this allergy, and that my life's unmanageable. And step two was my solution, and step three was real simple. You either keep doing what you're doing and shut up and leave us alone, or try life on a spiritual basis. And if you're willing to try life on a spiritual basis, you'll do a four step. And I did that. And I did my fifth step with my sponsor. And I came home for that, after the fifth step, for that hour of careful consideration of the first five proposals. And during that time, I had to go to the bathroom. And when I turned the light on, I saw my reflection in the mirror. And it was the first time I really saw who I was. How selfish and dishonest and inconsiderate and manipulative and what a horrible person I had been my entire life. It was devastating to me. But the miracle happened for me in step six and seven, because for the first time in my life, I know what is wrong with me. And I know with your direction and God's strength, I could change. And I started changing. I did my eighth and ninth step, and I had a lot of amends to make. And I hear a lot of people talk about living amends, but my book, the way I read it, it doesn't talk about that. It tells me to make amends and close the book, and that's done. And I live my life today the way I live my life is not making amends. I live my life the way I do today because I'm a different person. I'm different. I've never felt more free. You know, used to, the only time I thought I was free is if I wasn't in jail. And this is a whole new level of freedom. I started just doing these things, and at about 3.5 years, the judge called me in his chambers, and he said, Mickey, I hear about the good work you're doing in the community. What? I'm doing these things because I don't want to die. And he says, I hear about the good things you're doing. And even after being convicted by a jury, this judge released me from the bondage of the state of Texas. He said, I believe you're a changed person. Come to find out years later, his father was one of the founding members of Alcoholics Anonymous in our area. And so my probation officer, again, very influential in my life, wanted me to take things a little bit further. And I've learned to take the action, leave the results up to God. And in 1994, I received a full pardon from the governor of the state of Texas. And what's that about? Do I need that to boost my ego? I promise you I don't. But I knew God had some purpose in there. I knew that. And I had worked my way to in a nonprofit organization up to middle management. And some years ago, we had major funding cuts in the state of Texas. Now, I had not had to look for a job since I raised my hand in that AA meeting. But things just kept, the harder I worked, things just kept opening and opening. And so we had major funding cuts. And when you have major funding cuts, the first thing that goes is middle management. And so about 25 years ago, I was without a job and I didn't know what I was going to do. And I was unemployed for about 3 days. And I got a phone call and a familiar voice says, "Hey, I hear you're looking for a job." And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Well, why don't you come work for us?" And that familiar voice was my probation officer. Had I not gotten that pardon, I could not have worked at adult probation. And so in April of 20, I was able to retire from adult probation where I was on probation. Hell of a way to get your money back, but I really worked hard to try to keep people out of jail and prison that had alcohol and drug problems. And so, you know, it's been wonderful. I mean, things have just been great. But it has, every day has not been a holiday and every meal has not been a banquet. Life happens. When I was 6 years sober, I got really, really tired, but I was working hard. And I got really, really exhausted. And so I went to the doctor and he came back with a prognosis. He said, "Mickey, you have terminal cancer." And he said, "You better get your affairs in order. You got about 8 months to a year to live." I couldn't believe he was talking to the most important person at an AA meeting. And I remember I went out and I looked up and I said, "God, why me?" And I heard my sponsor's voice say, "Why not you?" So I surrendered to my cancer and I ended up at MD Anderson Hospital in Houston, the best hospital in the world. I went in and I met my doctor, my primary doctor, happens to be young, Italian. I mean, it was, you know, oh my God. And I was, why can't this be a wart on my finger other than the cancer that I had? I was 38 years old and I was diagnosed with stage 4 colorectal cancer. I remember going in to see my doctor and I said, "Doc, I know why I have this cancer." He said, "No, Mickey, you're too young. It's got to be genetic. You know, it's just, you know, you're too young." I said, "No, Doc, I'm telling you, I know why I have this cancer." He said, "Why?" I said, "From so many years of men blowing smoke up my ass." You got to know why, right? Somehow makes it better. So I surrendered to my cancer like I surrendered to my alcoholism. And I did radiation. I did chemotherapy. Lost every hair on my body. Had to fight the lesbians off. You know, I drank aloe vera juice. I slept on beds of magnets. I have crystals. I have feathers. I have burned sage. I went to churches where people talked in tongues, fell out on the floor. You know, if you came, I did Reiki, I did hands-on healing. If you came by and told me, "I believe this will help you," I'm in. I'm in. It wasn't important whether I believed it would work, but you believed it would work, and there's power in whatever you believe. And that was proven by the power of the lies I believed, you know? And so it's so important to pay attention to what it is that we believe. And we have the ability, you know, we had to abandon our old ideas and develop some new ones. And so I'm doing all this stuff, and I had a friend of mine, one of my scooter friends came by, and he said, "Mickey, are you angry with God?" And I said, "Angry with God?" I was so grateful I had done the work. I was so grateful that I knew where God's place was, and I knew where my place was, and that I didn't have those things confused. He said, "Are you angry with God? You know, you might die of this cancer." And I'm so grateful that I know that God didn't do this to me. Because if I believe for a minute that God's given me this cancer or is testing me somehow, then God is my problem. And God can't be my problem and my solution at the same time. So what is my choice to be? My choice is, "Father God, however this journey must end, allow me to walk it with the grace and dignity of a sober woman alcoholic, a one of your children that you have made." And so as of this, obviously I didn't die. And after all of that, I've been clean from cancer for 25 years. And Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. You know, a couple of things that happened, and then I'll shut up. About 20 years ago, I was, I get around, talk around, get emails. Now it's Facebook and all that stuff. But I got an email from a young woman named Kimberly who lives in Sugar Land, Texas, and which is about an hour and a half, 2 hours from where I live. And we communicated back and forth, and then my daughter and I went to meet Kimberly. And Kimberly's the daughter I gave up for adoption in 1972. How good is God? You know, I just know that if I keep turning the pages of the book and doing what's asked of me to do, to expect miracles, I know they will come. I was asked to go to a meeting one time and give my probation officer her one-year chip. I was 2.5 years sober, and I wasn't going to go because she had never told me she was in recovery. I mean, when I went to her office, we talked about me, you know? And she called me on the phone, and she said, "Will you please come give me my one-year chip?" She said, "Had I not seen Alcoholics Anonymous work in your life, I would not be sober today." We don't know who's watching. We don't know who's keeping an eye on us. But how cool is that? So I have 2.5 years more than my probation officer, and I never let her forget it. You know, it's been my honor to be here with you and the joy in this fellowship and pockets of enthusiasm. And, you know, I'm probably not what I should be, and I'm probably not what I could be, but thank God I'm not what I used to be. Thank y'all for having me.